And these two teachings, shunyata, the usually translated in the Theravada tradition as voidness or absence of, okay. Absence of self, the very thing that Karen is talking about, you know, investigating the nature of self and identity and whatnot, and the more deeply the investigation proceeds, the more begins to become apparent that maybe this thing we think of as a solid, permanent, and abiding self may not be the case. You know, it's a little bit like on Star Trek when they start to beam somebody up, and first they look solid, and then they're on these always points of light. Well, the Buddha invites us to consider the possibility that we are, in some ways, the thing we think of as self is more sort of a temporary apparition, you know, that we bring into being on an as-needed basis, and then after with some practice, after a while, you might be able to learn to let it go and relax it a little bit and kind of ease into the notion of self being a sometimes thing, right? And, there's that old folk song, you know, the water is wide, you know. And one of the verses in is, there is a ship and it sails the sea, it's loaded deep as deep can be, but not as deep as the love I'm in, I know not if I sink or swim. It's a kind of sort of in-between place. Sogyam Rinpoche talks about these sort of stages of being. He talks about the belief in, or the notion of, or the adherence to an idea of self being like ice, you know. And then letting go of that, being like the ice melting into water, right? And becoming fluid and without form. And said, actually, for the most part, most of us spend our lives in a state of slush. He's talking about Dharma students. Said we start to kind of let go, you know, give up a little bit on this hard, fast notion of self, but not quite ready to let it melt away yet. And so we tend to lead slushy lives. And then on occasion, when we feel threatened or upset or something, then suddenly we can freeze up, get very solid, right? Okay. And then other times when the mind becomes capable of really deep relaxation, then we get that sense of fluidity once again, of being able to sort of meld with whatever is, rather than feeling the need to establish, you know, rigid boundaries around ourselves. The Buddha actually used images, similes, and metaphors having to do with water a great deal in his teaching. Probably the most famous one is his parable of the raft, right? And one of the reasons, when he talked about a strong kind of raging river, his part of the of northeastern India, you know, they had monsoons every year, and they had a lot of flooding. And so the image of a strong, fast-moving river is very much on everyone's mind because they'd seen them frequently, you know, seasonally. And in this parable, of course, he says, you know, suppose you wish to cross over the river, but you have no means. You know, there's no boat, there's no ferry or anything. And so he said, if you really need to get across, then you can kind of fashion your own raft. You know, lashing together some, you know, branches and whatnot, and then climbing on board, and just sort of in that image, it's possible that you get this image, oh, a raft across over us, kind of like Huck and Jim on the Mississippi, right? Well, that's not really what he's describing at all. He says, he talks about lying on the raft and paddling with your hands and feet, so it's kind of like a homemade surfboard instead, kind of a dodgier apparatus, actually. For seeking to get across this swiftly moving river. And then he says, once you attain the other side, do you then hoist the raft on your back and carry it off with you along the trail? And he said, well, no, of course what you do is you leave it on the bank because it has fulfilled its function.
Okay.
So in using that, you know, that metaphor, he's of course saying, really introducing an element of provisionality in our relationship with the Dharma. Right? He's saying it's there for a reason. It's a tool. It's a means for crossing over. It's a means for freeing oneself from self. It's a means for the realization of freedom. And that once it has performed that function, it's to be let go of. Right? And so, for me, that's really a really meaningful message. Because I think that it's possible to get kind of precious about, you know, our practice or our understanding relative to somebody else's, for instance. And rather than, and you know, like Tanjeff says, you know, the stepwise evolution of spiritual maturity when we're first starting out, and we said, okay, well, if all suffering comes from clinging, and I just have to not cling, right? Okay, good luck with that. He said, step one, basically, is a matter of us simply trying to get more strategic in our clinging.
Yeah.
You know? So instead of clinging to material things, you know, find ourselves clinging to spiritual things, you know. Trungpa Rinpoche wrote a whole book about this, you know, spiritual materialism. And then eventually, we kind of cop to the Buddha's message here, where he's saying, you know, eventually you need to let go of that as well. You know? That being said, there's sometimes in Dharma practice when it's getting really rough, you know, when your little raft is heading into some pretty, you know, choppy white water, when, you know, you're hanging on for dear life, you know, and it's good to have that there when you really need it. And it's also good to know when there may be some wisdom and letting go, well, you know, that too. You know, it's to be, ultimately, to be a light, to be understood for its usefulness. He also used the same metaphor of the swollen river, the fast-moving river, to talk about craving and clinging. He said, suppose that you are in a situation where the waters are rising and you have to leave your home and get in a boat and make your way, you know, through the flood. And he said, you really must take care of what you choose to take with you, okay? And what to leave behind. And so in this use of the metaphor, he talks about a wealthy person who knows that he has to leave but wants to take everything with him that he possibly can, so he loads up his pockets with, you know, with gems and jewels and whatnot, and then gets out on the river and his boat falls apart, he sinks to the bottom and drowns because he was not willing to let go of all the stuff in his pockets, right? So it's this understanding of sort of the flow of nature and how are we going to relate to it? How are we going to steer our boat, steer our raft through these currents that we sort of find ourselves in right now? And that metaphor for me also really, I have a very dear friend of mine who he and I helped run the sort of outward bound style program at Prescott College a lot of years ago, and he's a really expert boatman. He's been a senior boatman on the Colorado through the Grand Canyon on several occasions. And he got in touch the other day and said, well, I'm putting together a trip. You want to go? 21 days on the river next March. Mm-hmm. And he said, Yeah, sure. I haven't done serious white water in about 20 years, of course.
No.
And I'm gonna have to be hitting the gym about 3 times a week from now to limb from having a shot at all. But some of the most important lessons that I've learned in life actually have been on the river. And it's turned out, you know, to be, for me, among the very most powerful teaching, the water-based teachings in Buddha Dharma are the ones that have, you know, some of the greatest meaning for me as well. Especially when he's talking about navigating floodwaters, you know. And then with this horrific tragedy in Orlando, it was like coming around the bend and realizing that, you know, this is a dangerous river we're on. Mm. You know, that stuff happens, that there is things come up that are unforeseen that need to be understood, need to be navigated, you know. And there was a part of me that just had no place to put this, mm-hmm. you know, just the sheer violent insanity of the whole thing, you know. In Colorado, starting in 2012, we had a series of worst fires in Colorado history, right? Because each one was bigger than the one before. Each one burned down more houses, in some cases killed more people. You know, it was just bigger and more violent than the one before. So we've just finished having the biggest, you know, mass murder in American history, right? And who knows how long before the next one happens. But there was just something about this that on the one hand had, is it unfathomable, no place to put it. But then in the context, sort of using that metaphor of reading the river historically, something that I remembered was this. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court handed down its landmark decision in Brown versus Board of Education. It's the one that said it matters of public education throughout the country, separate is inherently unequal. Okay. And the period, about the next 15 years, from the time that the Supreme Court handed down this decision in Brown v. Board through the 1968 presidential elections, were that constituted the most violent period in the modern civil rights era. Okay. There were more church bombings, more murders, assassinations during that period of time. Than either, you know, before or since, right? Because the order was changing, okay? Mm-hmm. First in the courts, okay, and then, you know, the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the education amendments after that that really basically revolutionized American politics in that, you know, the clergy and then the courts and then finally the Congress decided that it was important to really embody our most deeply held values, you know, in our laws, and they did so. And there was horrible, violent resistance because the order was changing, and those who had previously enjoyed power realized that they were losing it. And for me, it's important to keep that history in mind when I think about where we find ourselves now. It was just a few months ago that the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the Obergefell case, where it said it basically declared every law, every state law in the country that forbade same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional. Absolutely revolutionary decision. Okay, and it had the effect of, I think, really shaking some of these states in particular that had such laws to their core. And you mix that with the fact that we have some of the most hateful and bigoted rhetoric in recent political history being shared openly right now. And it just seems like these conditions are coming together that in some ways, for me, it begins to make it more understandable what we're facing right now. These are turbulent times, right? They're times of real change. And it's probably going to be a rough ride for a little while to come. You know, it's no accident that this is that, you know, that this mass shooting happened in Gay Pride Month. There is some consideration about the possibility of canceling the Gay Pride Parade in Los Angeles today because they discovered somebody with, who was summarily armed with, and he had explosives, and it looked as if he was planning to try to wreak the same kind of mayhem, right? So change of the, you know, positive social change of this nature does not happen easily or freely in a society such as ours, you know, especially one in which everyone, you know, unless they're either a felon or provably insane, has easy access to weaponry of, that was designed for the sole purpose of killing large numbers of people in a short period of time. Personally, I've gotten to the point where silence is no longer an option. You know, I'm going to begin to speak more openly and frequently, I think, at least in terms of my own personal views, about the need to start sort of a disarmament process, at least insofar as weapons of war in the hands of civilians is concerned, you know. And you know, this is going to be sort of enormous controversy around this, you know. I personally think that weapons of war don't really have any place in our society. And I've heard all the arguments, you know, the ones that say, oh, well, there's, you know, there are millions of these AK-47 or AR-15s out there, you know, it's passing a law won't do anything. He bought this one legally. Well, he did. That's right in and of itself is one thing, the fact that it's legal to buy weapons like that. And, oh, well, you know, if you outlawed them, they wouldn't make any difference because there's so many out there. When I hear that argument, I think about Dr. Jonas Salk. He was the inventor of the polio vaccine. You know. Let's imagine that when he invented the vaccine and he went to the government for funding to mass produce it so we could start protecting people from polio, they said, well, we're sorry, Dr. Salk, but you can't immediately eradicate polio from the world, right? You can't give a dose to everybody instantly and no one gets polio again. And he said, no, it's going to take time. It's going to take about 30 years, and it did. You know. Same is true with regard to the public health threat posed by military weaponry in society. You know. It's going to take time. You know. Australians did it in 10 years. It's not that it's not doable. It's that there need to be enough people who care enough about it to steer the raft around that particular rapid. You know. Good. So, any thoughts about anything that I've said so far here this evening? Yes, please.
So I always come, I think about or get faced with, and I never know what to do with it, with the notion of equanimity.
Yes.
And I feel the way when I could be happy if we outlawed the Second Amendment. We don't, seriously. Mm-hmm. But then someone will say, but we have to give the other point of view its due. I mean, isn't that the Buddhist way? Is it?
The Buddhist way, in terms of the teachings of the Buddha, is non-harming. Ahimsa. He advocated not harming others. Not harming sentient beings. And he was pretty straight up about that, just like Jesus of Nazareth was. You know, these were people who taught peace. And so the idea of having, you know, a little chat about whether or not we should be able to blow each other away at a moment's notice, you know, is not kind of really part of the Buddhist frame. You know, he taught, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Yeah. What would the Buddha do in terms of the politics of, common sense gun regulation? I don't know. But his starting point, his position was that of non-harming. Yeah. So I have heard the position taken that, well, you know, the way to avoid harm is to be well armed. So it's a different view of what kind of society we want to live in, what really makes for a peaceful society. But the goal of not harming each other is right at the core of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. Anything else? Any other comments or reflections? Questions? Okay. Yeah, please, Don.
Just wondering, how do the courts interpret the words militia, for instance, a well-ordered militia, or a well-regulated militia? What is a militia? Is it every citizen owning a gun and able to be called up when the defense of the country is required? Or is it our National Guard, in which the weapons are kept in the armory and distributed as necessary,
yes,
to people who have been trained and are being led?
Yes. That was the nature of the debate that happened over the Supreme Court's recent string of decisions finding that the Second Amendment did contemplate private gun ownership.
And it did, or did it?
That it did. And this was the majority who called themselves sort of the originalists, you know, including Justice Scalia when he was still in his body. Their argument was that we should look to the original intent of the Constitution in interpreting this language in the present day. And back then, we didn't have a standing uniformed militia. We had the farmers who fought the Revolutionary War, and then they came home and they said, okay, well, if we get jammed up again, then, you know, get the old flintlock off the mantle and, you know, go down to the town square. And so they're saying, well, that was the original intent, and so therefore we need to discover there to be a right to bear arms privately. And they care. That's been the majority. They've been 5-4 decisions, each of them, for the most part, having to do with whether or not Second Amendment contemplates a right to private gun ownership. That being said, every time the court recently has decided that the Second Amendment does include private gun ownership rights, it's always said those rights are not absolute, that they are subject to reasonable regulation. And then the whole question goes to what constitutes reasonable regulation. Okay. In order for there to be like an assault weapons ban, it would have to be an act of Congress, which, you know, right now doesn't look like it's got a prayer, but who knows after November what may or may not be possible. We'll have to see. Yeah. Please.
I think that there also has to be something about not just me not causing harm to others, but also not just standing by and letting other people harm themselves and others. I mean, the shooter in Orlando, or the shooters at Columbine, the Aurora Theater, any of those people have brought harm to themselves as well. So whichever side it's looked at from, there's a need to take some action to prevent harm.
Right, in terms of making it more difficult for people to be able to hurt each other. Yeah.
Right, right. In terms of not not knowingly giving them the means to cause more harm than they probably even want to take on.
Thank you.
I just wanted to follow up.
Yeah, please.
How can it be reasonably argued that no matter whether it's a militia or not, it's well regulated? It is not. It's wide open.
That's where we're at right now. That's, we're wide open. And we're wide open.
Anybody can get a gun. Doesn't matter how crazy you are. Doesn't matter your political beliefs.
It matters what state you're in. That's the interesting thing. There are some states like Connecticut and, you know, actually in Colorado, things got tightened up a little bit after the Aurora Theater shooting. But there's enormous variation. There's an assault weapons ban in California. And the shooters in San Bernardino, somebody bought their weapons for them in Nevada. You know, which laws are pretty much headed the opposite direction. So it's probably going to take a national action to really bring it in.
And maybe the militia aspect is mute because whoever has an 18-year-old knows that the law just got changed, and every 18-year-old has to register in this country. So every citizen or every male or female between 18 and 35 is a militia person, by definition.
Potentially. Yeah, these are grave issues, but it seems the time has come to, you know, instead of saying, wow, this is a really rough river, maybe we need to start being a little smarter about how we seek to take care of ourselves as we go down it. So the next few months are going to be an interesting ride, whatever role you decide to play or not. So there's other teachings in Buddha Dharma also. They use the image of water that I thought might be worth sharing this evening. I actually want to read excerpts from a Dharma talk that Suzuki Roshi gave a long time ago, back in the 1960s. They got gathered into this little book. It was published in 1970, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. You know, a dear teacher of mine, I hold in high regard from my seminary days, Ajahn Amaro, was a Thai forest monk. He was a student of Ajahn Chah and his monastery in southeastern Thailand. He stayed there for many, many years and became one of the more senior monks there. And then Ajahn Chah suggested he go back to Europe and begin to teach. And so he's very widely regarded and highly regarded, widely renowned Theravada Buddhist teacher of British lineage. And he said when he first got to Ajahn Chah's monastery and just undertook the vows and you really started to learn Thai and there's a, they have sort of adjoining sort of monasteries. One is for European newbies to come and kind of start getting with the program a little bit, and then if they decide they really want to, you know, go for it big time, they can move to the other monastery and start working on their Thai. And so he did that. But he said when he first got there, he was very inspired, and so he was taking the vows of the Theravada monastic order, and so he was asking the monk who was responsible for kind of running their little kind of boot camp for European Dharma students there, getting him used to the situation. He said, "Well, do you have any books or readings that I should really study to start, you know, getting a feel for this practice and really how to do it?" And said, and this Thai monk that was kind of running the show there, he said, "Well, yes, many Westerners have found this book particularly useful." They had a copy of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind there. Suggested you read that first, you know, even though it's all about Zen practice. But Suzuki Roshi really had a way of speaking to everyone, whether they find themselves to be following the Zen path or not. So his he was founder of the San Francisco Zen Center and the Tassajara Zen Center in Northern California. He writes, "If you go to Japan and visit the Eiji Monastery, just before you enter, you'll see a small bridge, Hanshaku Yokio, mean half-dipper bridge. Whenever Dogen Zen sees dipped water from the river, he used only half a dipper full, returning the rest to the river again without throwing it away. That is why we call the bridge half-dipper bridge. When we wash our face, we fill the basin to just 70% of its capacity in this monastery. And after we wash, we empty the water towards rather than away from our body. This expresses respect for the water. This kind of practice is not based on any idea of being economic. It may be difficult to understand why Dogen returned half the water he dipped to the river. This kind of practice is beyond our thinking. When we feel the beauty of the river, when we are one with the water, we intuitively do it in Dogen's way. It is our true nature to do so. But if your true nature is covered by ideas of economy or efficiency, Dogen's way makes no sense. So what he's talking about here is getting beyond the discursive and actually feeling the water in ourselves and its connection with the water and the environment. When the Buddha taught the Four Elements meditation, he talked about feeling the elements internally, feeling the breathing coming and going, okay. Feeling the flow of life in the body, right? The flow, you know. Priscilla talked about experiencing the air element, breathing, you know, the water element, the fire element in terms of temperature, the pulse, the earth element in terms of the sensation, the solidity of the body touching whatever you're sitting on. And then gradually moving over and not focusing on nouns, but on gerunds, you know, breathing, flowing, pulsating, touching, experiencing the four elements not as things but as processes, you know, as sort of literally who we are, because we are all, in fact, this ongoing flow. And so it says, talks about experiencing the elements internally when you're sitting, and then he talks about experiencing the elements externally. And what it means by that is if you go out and do walking meditation, and you're experiencing the breathing internally, and then you see the breeze flowing through the leaves and the trees. You feel the breeze on your skin, you feel it fluttering, okay? So you're experiencing the air element externally, okay? If there's a nearby stream or flowing water of any kind, you know, you experience the water element by seeing it and hearing it, and you're reminded of the water element that's within, okay? You feel the heat of the sun on your body, okay? You experience the fire element, you experience it externally, you experience it internally, okay? You see the earth and its apparent solidity, okay? You feel the solidity of your own body, okay? So you're experiencing the earth element as you walk around outside. And so he talks about experiencing them internally, experiencing them externally, and then internally and externally both. And the way to do that, and this is something I always, first off, when I go on retreats, I usually try to go to places where there's a big natural open expanse, right? And I actually spend a lot of my sitting time out in nature someplace. And if you're doing this kind of practice in a natural setting, you know, out in a forest somewhere, it just really, and you can do this just going for hikes and, you know, city and regional state parks right around where we live. You know, if you can go out and sit in nature sometimes and you do these, this like four elements practice, somehow or another, it really becomes much easier just to kind of melt into the landscape a little bit and feel like there's no difference, you know, because you're just doing exactly what the Buddha suggested that we do. You know, just get in touch with who we are, you know, through our senses in relationship to our natural surroundings, or surroundings, period, and a very sort of whole, and in some cases, kind of extra-rational way. I just came back from this annual meeting of the Law and Society Association in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I was part of a panel where we were talking about disaster management and whatnot. One of the panelists was a professor at one of the law schools there, and he said, and when his friends come from California and elsewhere, and he takes them out canoeing, you know, going up a bayou or a little tributary to the Mississippi or something like that. So they always comment on how trashed the place looks, you know, because there's old rusted, you know, gas tanks and pipes and stuff hanging around along the river's edge from time to time. And he said, they said, well, you know, it's not nearly as pretty as it is in the, you know, sort of the back country in California and Colorado. And he said, if we were to have any hope at all of healing this planet that we live on, he said, we have to learn to love scarred landscapes. We have to learn to love things as they are in order for them to heal. So instead of this sort of despairing when we see the way things are trashed, you know, like the Orange River flowing from the Gold King mine down into the Los Angeles, you know, look at the ways, you know, so there are, you know, the mountains of Colorado have been royally trashed for 100 years. And it's our job now to heal from that, to restore, to bring back. But we have to be able to embrace things as they are in order to be able to do that. And then Suzuki continues, he said, I went to Yosemite National Park and I saw some huge waterfalls. The highest one there is 1,340 feet high, and from it the water comes down like a curtain thrown from the top of the mountain. It does not seem to come down swiftly as you might expect. It seems to come down very slowly because of the distance. And the water does not come down as one stream, but is separated into many tiny streams. From a distance, it looks like a curtain, and I thought that it must be a very difficult experience for each drop of water to come down from the top of such a high mountain. It takes time, you know, a long time for the water finally to reach the bottom of the water. And it seems to me that our human life may be like this. We have many difficult experiences in our life, but at the same time, I thought, the water was not originally separated, but was one whole river. Only when it is separated does it have some difficulty in falling. It is as if the water does not have any feeling when it is one with the whole river. Only when separated into many drops can it begin to have or express some feeling. When we see one whole river, we do not feel the living activity of water. But when we dip into a part of the river with a dipper, we experience the feeling. We also feel the value of the person who uses the water. Feeling ourselves in the water in this way, we cannot use it in just a material way. It is a living thing, a sacred thing. Before we were born, we had no feeling. We were one with the universe. This is called mind only, or essence of mind, or big mind. After we are separated by birth from this oneness, as the water falling from the waterfall is separated by the wind and rocks, then we have feeling. You have difficulty because you have feeling. You attach to the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. When you do not realize that you are one with the river or one with the universe, you have fear. Whether it is separated into drops or not, water is water. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, and we have no actual difficulty in our life. Useful metaphors. So, any reflections or thoughts? Yes, please.
So your earlier discussion and this one kind of fit in an interesting way, and like what I wonder and what I've been struggling with today and reading about all of these people is like, how do you advocate on behalf of something while holding some kind of like no self value, like even like to be even to be an ally, you have to hold some kind of identity thing, and even
yes.
to, like, there's an auto identify in there, and, like, it's been a struggle for me at least to not identify, but also to identify with the experiences of people who are queer, just like me, who get shut up in a club when they're just out for a Saturday night.
Yes, yes. Well put. I think it becomes a matter of learning how to identify skillfully. You know, just as we, you know, sort of conjure the self for various purposes, right? It can also be very useful to, and this, I'm not, you know, it's something that happens quite naturally. The Buddha talked about not self, because sometimes now you see it, now you don't. When the mind is creating self, there is self, right? And the problem is that we create self automatically and reflexively without understanding that we're doing it or without any control. And then when we do that, self controls us. And too often self expresses itself in greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the Buddha's teaching is about, you know, if you see the self coming into being and you understand the reasons why, then there can be such a thing as the skillful construction of self, if you're doing it knowingly and knowledgeably and for a purpose in order to convey a message or something like that. As long as you're not being driven by this construct that you've created. And the same, I think, can be true when you are find it really important to be true to your own identity in a situation like this. You know, I think what became clear is kind of like what Suzuki Ryoki was talking about. You know, you can think about those 50 people who lost their lives or those individual drops of water, right? And kind of atomized or separated or whatnot. But it's also possible to think about them as part of a great flow, you know, that there's something about what happened to them that is, it's kind of like the assassination in the church in Charleston. It's showing us as a nation some aspect of who we are that we find unacceptable and unthinkable, right? And that way, these people, without knowing it, may have given their lives in a great cause. You know, there is this great force moving forward, and it's very terrible. And it's possible to worry about our individuality in that, or to be enraged or overcome by identity in a way that it drives us instead of us being able to use it skillfully. But I think that the great leaders of the civil rights movement were able to stay spiritually grounded, but also very forcefully use their rhetoric and their personalities in order to achieve a great goal. So it's not easily done. You know, just as we, you know, I was advocating, you know, maybe trying to de-escalate or, you know, engage in civil disarmament to some extent here, I think it's going to be really useful to be able to engage in some degree of disarmament when it comes to political speech. Because now it's so, you know, people use words as weapons, you know, with the intention of causing maximum harm, you know. And so to learn how to powerfully convey a message in a non-dual way, I think it can be the most powerful means of communication, you know. Martin Luther King had it down, you know, as did Gandhi. You know, it's a high standard that they set, but they showed it can be done, you know. And I think that's exactly what needs to happen now in terms of the movement with regard to, you know, the diversity of our means of expression of who we are and who we love. You know, it's going to take that kind of focus and forthright effort and a sense of higher purpose, I think, for it to succeed. And I think it will. Yeah, let's do just a little music before we go to say praise. Although, say the words to each verse of the song by Pete Seeger before we sing it together. So fine, I would weave a magic band of rainbow design, of rainbow design. Across our rainbow race, a love that knows